I'm bored. What plaything can you offer me today?
An obscure body in the SK system, Your Majesty. The inhabitants refer to it as the planet Earth.
How peaceful it looks.
Most effective, Your Majesty. Will you destroy this Earth?
Later. I like to play with things a while before annihilation.
Hi, and welcome to Pod Stallions. I'm Brian, and with me as always is Jason.
Hello, everybody.
And this is an episode that we've been kind of talking about since we first kicked around, and it's pretty obvious that Jason and I are both huge Flash Gordon fans, Jason more than myself, and it seemed like a great idea to do a whole episode just devoted to Flash Gordon, mostly the 1980 film that impacted both of us, but also the character itself and our beginnings with it.
Yeah, I think so. It's just as we made our initial lists of fun things to cover in, you know, a dozen or so episodes, Flash Gordon, I think, was in there somewhere. And it's just something that connects us, as all these things do, but in a strange way, because it is such a specific film. There's a specific love for that film. It's kind of like a secret handshake, I always say, when you find people that really know and love that movie. But it goes beyond the movie. I mean, actually, we'll get to this, but it's in a strange way the first thing that sort of connected Brian and I via email in a really bizarre way. And there's lots of ancillary stuff around it. You know, it my love for the character, you know, started just a little bit before the movie, but combined with that and the movie itself, it's sort of been a lifelong love. And yet, you know, I don't have like a huge Flash Gordon collection of everything ever made of Flash Gordon. It's very specific, the stuff that I love.
But yeah, I'm in the same way. I have a few choice pieces, but I don't buy everything with Flash Gordon's face on it.
Right. It's and we'll get to some of these weird things, because you've got all these great, you know, catalog pages and reference materials that have shown me things for the character that I didn't know ever existed, that I've since tried to track down to add to the bits and pieces I have. But I guess we should start with our introductions to the character. And they're quite different, I think. But what about you? How did it sort of start for you?
Well, you know, the first thing I remember seeing Flash Gordon in is probably the back of comic books. Remember they had those ads for T-shirt or patches?
Sure.
You know, and they would have characters in the back that, you know, they would have all these different patches, like 100 different patches, and they'd have, you know, Snuffy Smith and Flash Gordon. And, I remember going like, who the hell's Flash Gordon? You know, I probably didn't say it like that, but you know, four. But that's probably where I first saw him.
Uh-huh.
But then there was a program on TVO, the same public channel that played Doctor Who, called Magic Shadows.
Okay.
And Magic Shadows, you know, they could play a movie, but they had to have an educational segment about the movie. And these things were hosted by a fellow by the name of Elwie Yost. And Elwie was this kind of charming, agreeable, educated man that loved movies. Mm. And he was still a kid at heart. And his son is Hollywood screenwriter Graham Yost.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah, yeah. And
it's funny.
Elwie used to play the movie serials.
Mm.
And I got hooked on those at a very early age because I think he played Captain America when I was about five.
Oh, wow.
And I remember being really crestfallen with that serial because, you know, Captain America was kind of this chubby guy with no shield and a gun. But, you know, I still watched every episode. And then I would watch, I think over those years, I watched every serial that they played, you know, Commando Cody, the Captain, the beautiful Captain Marvel ones, the mysterious Dr. Satan, Buck Rogers, and Flash Gordon. So that was probably my first exposure to the character was the Buster Crabbe serials at the time. And, you know, I was fond of them, but I thought they were kind of goofy at the same time. Obviously, mm-hmm. the special effects don't translate very well in 1976 or whenever I was watching them. And there was also another channel playing them called City TV. They would play Flash Gordon, and they had a particularly goofy commercial for it, kind of mocking the show. I'd love to see it again, but I remember it really well, just guys on the street pretending to, you know, they'd see a scene from Flash Gordon, and they were acting it out. And it was, they were playing it for camp value like on Saturday afternoons.
And that's funny.
That's my first exposure to Flash Gordon. So, you know, the kind of Art Deco looks to the show and the comic strip and all that. They didn't jive with me as a kid. And then, to be honest with you, the movie kind of turned me around on that style.
Mm.
That kind of retro future style, and I'll talk a little bit more about that when we get down there. But I'm gonna guess, and even before I ran the show rundown, I knew your dad may have had something to do with your first exposures to Flash Gordon.
Well, you know what it was. You know, when you really think about it, my brain was Star Wars crazy. You know, and my dad liked Star Wars too. He wasn't one of. I mean, I can see another generation of parents going, oh, are you kidding me? This is terrible stuff. You know, I'm sure there was a batch of that going on. But my dad loved it, and he then tried to turn me on to things that he loved, you know, as a kid, like Terry and the Pirates and, you know, the Buck Rogers strip and I think the Flash Gordon strip. And he got me this giant hardcover Buck Rogers reprint book with an introduction by Harlan Ellison. I think it's an introduction by either Bradbury or Harlan Ellison, I forget. And it reprints all the stuff from the 30s. And in the back, I remember in the back just pouring over these pages, the back five or six pages were photographs of merchandise, Buck Rogers, you know, merchandise and toys that were made in the 30s, like the gun and holster, you know, a wagon, you know, metal wagon, model ships, things like that, that I was just I'd obsess over these photographs. And I think he either got me something of Flash Gordon or he turned me on to Flash Gordon as well, saying, well, that's another one that was great. It was something like that. I mean, I don't know if I was overly familiar by the time I was 6, 7, 8 years old with who the character was. I mean, it was just one of those names, too, that, like, you just would hear, like, what does this guy think? He's Flash Gordon, you know? Or, you know, it's just like a...
You bring up a good point. It did kind of, like, you'd hear someone on MASH say it, or...
Yes.
Yeah, it was in pop culture.
Yeah, and yes. I think it may be even at this point, and I might be getting this timeline wrong, but I may have even seen black and white shots of Buster Crabbe as both characters. Because, you know, as most geeks know, he played Buck Rogers and... Flash Gordon, and I think he played Tarzan as well at some
point. Yes, he did. He was Tarzan at one point. Yeah.
Well, he
and then I think he turned into Jungle Jim after that.
He had all the pulp characters.
He really did. He really did.
Yeah. So I might have even seen some pictures in something like Starlog or some science fiction book. You know that you know it might have even been. I had a great book that I think has been reprinted since, but it's one of the earliest Star Wars books called the Star Wars Album.
Oh, yeah.
And it's got the Hildebrand art on the cover of the poster. And inside, it sort of, you know, celebrates the film. But also, you know, remember, like on one page, there's a great picture of Harrison Ford as Han Solo, you know, shooting at the stormtroopers. And the next page is Gary Cooper from High Noon. And it's trying to say that these are all archetypes that have been in movies for so long. And I'm pretty sure there were pictures in there of, you know, Flash and Dale and Ming kind of thing. So I was kind of aware, but I don't think I'd ever seen, you know, any of the serials before the dawning of the gorgeous, fantastic wonderful Filmation Adventures of Flash Gordon animated series. And of course, being, you know, Star Wars crazy, you know, on Saturday mornings, I was looking for anything that could fill that gap. We had Jason of Star Command.
I loved it.
Which was pretty cool for various reasons, not least of which the man's name. That got me to tune in every...
That didn't have much effect.
Have much effect on you. No. Big effect on me. You know, Battle of the Planets. Another Jason character.
I'm seeing a trend.
Jason and the Argonauts. there's a reason that they retitled G-Force Battle of the Planets. I mean, it basically is... Translation is Star Wars, you know.
And that show was also, that show was also like 5 years old by the point we got it.
It totally was. You know, I'm looking at it again years later, and I mean, maybe when I say years later, maybe like early 80s or mid 80s, seeing it again, it didn't hit me until then that they were, like, how long the hair was and how flared the trousers were. And, you know, it definitely was from like the early 70s, but they stuck that robot in there and the dog, and, you know, in on the heels of Star Wars, you had another sci-fi show that could air in the daytime. So we were getting our fill any which way we could. And then I don't know how I discovered it, if it was an ad in a comic book or I just came across it on NBC on Saturday morning. The Filmation Flash Gordon animated series completely blew my mind.
There was an ad for it in comic books. Remember when they used to do that? You would get a comic book in August, and it would say, "Tune in this September," and it have all these weird drawings of shows.
Morning shows, yeah.
Yeah, I used to look forward to that. I love those ads.
Oh, yeah, totally.
Yeah.
And they would do those shows, too. You remember the preview shows they would do, like, on
the week? Oh, my gosh, yeah.
It'd be like a preview of what's coming up for Saturday mornings?
It's killing me. On YouTube, there's one for NBC. And it's hosted by Freddie Prinze. And it all the segments are for kids from Caper. And whoever's got this thing, they've got a beautiful, pristine copy of it.
Oh,
but
wow.
They only put the Kids from Caper segments on it, and I want to see the Monster Squad segments.
Yeah, I want to see the whole thing. I'd be
curious. Oh, yeah, actually, sorry. Yeah, I'm just hoping for anything. But, I loved those things. I would watch those.
Oh, yeah.
Up until the point when I was like 15, 16, and I wasn't going to watch the actual cartoons.
Yeah, I kind of, as we aged, and I'm not trying to knock anything that came after, you know, we sort of stopped watching cartoons, but I kind of compare those ads and those shows to the Sears catalogs, where as the years wore on, by the time you got to like the early 80s, it was getting further and further away from stuff I was interested in because, you know, Star Wars had kind of gone away already. It was much more G.I. Joe and He-Man and Teddy Ruxpin and things like that. And it just started to get further away from, I mean, I was growing up as well.
Yeah, I think that had a lot to do with it.
Same thing was happening with the Saturday morning stuff. So I come across Flash Gordon, and for those of you that have seen it, you'll know what I'm talking about. Those of you that haven't, I cannot recommend getting to this show fast enough. I always say, to me, this is all my opinion, my personal opinion, best three animated series ever done, Johnny Quest, Batman the Animated Series, and Flash Gordon, the Filmation Adventures of Flash Gordon. The consistency, the design. I mean, when you see Flash Gordon, it's just like these characters looked better than they ever had. There was definitely a love for the Alex Raymond stuff and the original, you know, the origins of the character. And the show is very much sticks to what the strip stories were, you know, how they get to Mongo and Earth being in jeopardy and how they meet everybody and, you know, team up and whatever. But it's just the design work for the characters is extraordinary. I mean, I think I had a feeling at nine, I couldn't have known, well, this is a Filmation show. You know, I did
put
that together, but I knew that it looked similar to Star Trek because I loved Star Trek animated series.
That's one thing I didn't know how to say his name, but when I saw that circle, I'd say it's a Schemer cartoon, which was Scheimer.
Sure.
And I actually told Lou Scheimer that story.
Oh, that's funny.
Because I said, I knew your name, and I knew I liked your shows.
Well,
I was addicted to Filmation. We should do a whole Filmation show.
Oh, we totally could. But that's the thing we're talking about in one of the episodes before, where we were those kids that could see a face in a show and go, wait a minute, he's the guy that played the alien in the thing last week or whatever.
Yeah.
And I knew, one thing I knew that pretty quickly, and I started to put it together, these must be the same people that are doing this, was a year or two before was that incredible Tarzan animated series.
The Tarzan and the New Adventures of Batman were real highlights for me as a kid.
My brother, at that point, I've mentioned him before, being hugely into Edgar Rice Burroughs. I mean, when he read the first book, he devoured every Tarzan book that was out there. Then he moved on to John Carter. And when I got a little bit older, I started reading all these books. He was glued to that Tarzan show. And so if I was, seven, my brother must have been 16.
I can top you on that. My friend's 70-year-old dad found out I had them on DVD recently and asked me to give him copies of them all.
Wow.
Because he my buddy said to me, my dad used to watch that show religiously every Saturday morning.
Because you know why? If you know the character at all from those books,
it's perfect.
It's perfect. It's really, it's incredibly accurate. And it's the only time that we've actually seen other creatures speaking to him and them having conversations.
And it's like, taken seriously. Tarzan's not a monosyllabic idiot. No. I hate me Tarzan Eugene.
He's bright. I mean, the only concession I think for the youngsters was Nakima, his little pal that he carried on his shoulder. But I knew that something was similar, and I also knew, unless I'm completely wrong and I haven't looked this up in years, that the same guy that did the voice of Tarzan was doing the voice of Flash Gordon.
Was it Robert Ridgely on both? I think you're right.
Almost positive.
The Colonel from Boogie Nights.
And it's I recognize that voice.
Destructive when you watch it.
It really is, because he even shows up in that. He's in Blazing Saddles.
He's Thundar too.
He's Thundar as well. I think he might do all three of them. Yeah.
Yeah.
And he just, you just wouldn't put his face and body together with such a voice.
He has a barrel chested man's voice.
Yeah,
he's kind of a sloppy get looking guy.
So you get, in this animated series, you've got Flash, Dale, and Zarkov. You've got Thun the Lion Man. You've got Prince Baron. You've got Vulton the Hawkman. You've got Ming and Princess Aura. And everybody talk. We'll get to the movie in a second. But boy, oh boy, Princess Aura in the animated series is the single sexiest cartoon female there has ever been.
I can give you an anecdote on that. I was... I bought it when that came out on DVD. I bought it right away, and I got my son into it because he was about 5 or 6.
Right.
And I thought, I'm gonna treat you to this show, and he really did like it. Okay. But Princess Aura walked on the screen once while my wife was picking up toys, and she's just like, "What the hell is that?" And yeah, she's a very voluptuous and attractive cartoon character.
Even in the coloring books, looking back on it, you do kind of go, "Wow, they got away with that!" Like she's barely wearing anything, and she's very out there. And she make no bones about it. She was after Flash. I mean, she really dug him. But what it did was it just everything about it, the colors, the music, had an incredible theme. They did rotoscoping. Again, your 8-9-year-old brain doesn't click necessarily, but you find out later the reason those ships looked so amazing was they used models, and they like rotoscoped over model footage to put in the show. It also was serialized, and Shimer always talked about it. It was probably the downfall of the show. It was hard to repeat it and just pick up episodes anywhere you want. It told a story in a serial. Chapter 12, The Moons of Mongo. That was Shimer doing the announcements too. He does all the narration, the announcements and stuff.
The only thing that I will say about that show that used to bug me was that you could tell Flash and Baron were the same dude. Because Ridgely would do the Baron's voice a little.
I always thought that the guy that was doing Ming was doing Baron as well. And that's Alan Oppenheimer, who then did
Skeletor. Right? Yeah. And he was tiny on G-Force.
Yeah, I think he might be doing Baron and Ming.
No, I think Robert Ridgely is.
He's doing both?
I'm pretty sure, yeah.
Well, here's what's even more interesting, because we can really start to digest this animated thing. If you look back at the animated series and you just pop in that first episode, it does feel like you're dropping into a story that's already started. Because they're already on their way to Mongo, and there's some narration saying, you know, Flash, Dale, and Zarkov on their way to Mongo, blah, blah,
were
blah.
Were you lucky enough to see the TV movie?
I have it on DVD.
No, but as a kid, did you
no.
catch it?
Oh,
see,
no, no.
I saw it in Starlog. I remember Starlog showed a picture of Ming talking to Hitler and said, this is in the... you know, the on-air or the TV movie version. And I was like, when did that happen? And I was lucky enough to catch it in the summer of probably 79 or 80. They played it one day.
Oh, wow.
And I do remember, you know, it showed Flash Gordon in Poland and leaving with Dr. Zarkov. And I remember thinking, oh, I get it now. You know,
there's a good 30 minutes that never made it into the Saturday morning show and still aren't available on DVD, where I think it's in Berlin or someplace, or London or someplace that's crumbling during the war.
I think it's Krakow.
And he comes along, a scientist that gives him Zarkov's name. You know, Flash is in like civilian clothes, and, you know, Hitler is in there and having that radio conversation on a screen with me. And it's really cool stuff. There's like, you know, Stukas and Spitfires in the air, having dogfights and stuff. I don't know exactly why that never made it onto the official DVD release, but it hasn't. And then, you know, once you get past that first 20, 30 minutes when he meets Dale on an airplane and they meet Zarkov and then Zarkov takes them on the ship, that's when the story kicks off for this Saturday morning thing. But there's a lot more there. Interestingly enough, and I'm going to get this kind of wrong or muddled, that same Starlog article had a great bits of information that they were trying to figure out how to finish the series. They were running out of money or something. And Dino De Laurentiis, a famous Italian, you know, film producer who just come off of King Kong, remake of King Kong, and dozens of things he'd done, was getting this big budget live action feature together and thought, you know, one could help the other. The attention to this thing could help this thing. And so he, you know, not only were they sharing their visuals with De Laurentiis, the production was sharing a lot of their design work with De Laurentiis and his crew. He then gave them the extra money that was needed to finish this thing. And they ended up getting it like a European theatrical release for, you know, the 90-minute movie kind of thing.
Yeah. Scheimer in his book has nothing but good things to say about Dino De Laurentiis.
Oh, good.
And he even comes into play at the end when Scheimer's losing Filmation, that he was trying to get money together to get Scheimer to kind of get Filmation back. It's not fresh in my memory anymore, but he was really a big help to them. And so he was really behind that animated series quite a bit.
I'm eating this show up like mad. I don't even know if, because it got shuffled around on Saturday mornings, if I saw much of the second season, because by the time they get to the second season, they toned it down. It wasn't one half-hour story. It was in two different stories in the half hour, and then they brought in that little floating.
I forgot about the little you know. Like, what are they? They always Filmation started doing that with everything.
Yeah.
The little what do you call the mascot-y type, the Batmite.
Yeah. Yeah. And they brought him in, you know, for the kids that are in it. And I've seen all those now, and, you know, they're good to just see, but it's a different animal altogether because it's much more slapstick and younger audience. And they were trying to get a bigger audience. But that initial run, that initial first season of, I don't know, 20 episodes or whatever it was, and that run in chapter form is just fantastic. But meantime, and I've tried to think about this, you know, before this conversation. You know, I don't know how many – there were a lot of toy lines out there. There were a lot of movie toy lines out there. There were a lot of original things out there. There were a lot of things that were made based on franchises that were sort of, you know, in existence. Like the Mego Star Trek stuff was years after the series aired, but it was right at the height of its syndication madness before Star Wars came along. The Planet of the Apes thing for the TV series, but then the glut of merchandise had to do with all the films because they were so popular being run on television. When I look at the Mattel Flash Gordon line of toys, it's called, you know, the Flash Gordon, the greatest adventure of all. Mattel did a series of two different sets of figures I think, 4 or 5 and then 4 and 5 again. So you have, like, between 8 and 10 characters.
I think you're right.
They did Flash, Ming, Captain Arak, Zarkov, Beastman, Voltan,
Lizard Woman. Isn't there just like a Beastman? Did you mention
that? Yeah, I got him.
Okay.
So 7 or 8 characters. So the first batch were like 4 characters, and the next ones came out like that, the final, in the spring of 80 or something.
Beautiful card art.
Gorgeous. Gorgeous card art. That front card art is the best ever made. And then the figures are, you know, 5 points of articulation, mostly with an accessory. Then you had 2 ships. One was a smaller ship called Ming Shuttle, which was green plastic with a silver hood. And then they took that same piece and added it to a giant inflatable rocket ship that looked very much like the big round one that Zarkov flew in the first episode. And they attached that canopy onto it, and you've got this beautiful big ship. They made 2 laser guns, Ming's pistol and Flash Gordon's pistol, which was the Mattel electronic pistol that was used for Battlestar Galactica, with the kind of a egg shape on the end and
three different
sounds and stuff. I tracked, 25 years ago, I found the Ming pistol in the box, full working order, and I've since found the Flash Gordon one loose from a jumble sale on eBay in England, but I've never seen either of them again, and I've never seen the Flash Gordon one boxed, but that's one of my missions in life. So all this stuff is out there, but I can't think of another time that an animated series that, again, we always talk about this with rack toys and different things, that you don't know what the shelf life is going to be, got a full-fledged action figure series to go with it.
Yeah, you know what? You're right. I mean, none of the other, like, Jason of Star Command or Tarzan got an action figure series, especially as nice. I think that has a lot to do with the Star Wars effect.
Yeah.
Star Wars got something. I mean, Mego in 1978 also picked up Flash Gordon right after Star Wars hit and released a absolutely gorgeous set of action figures in a playset that absolutely nobody asked for, based on the Alex Raymond artwork.
Yeah, and they're beautiful. And aren't they also kind of a 10-inch range or a 9-inch?
Yeah, they didn't use that 10-inch range much. Doctor Who had it. Logan's Run was supposed to have it, but of course that got canceled. And Flash Gordon. And yeah, I think the 10-inch range was done so they could get a little more detail on the stuff, like on the suits and that sort of thing. Not only are they gorgeous, but they come with absolutely everything.
Yeah, and that's the problem. Like, they're try to find them now, carded, they're a bundle, but try to find them loose with everything, it's near impossible, because they came with, each of the male characters came with helmets and holsters and then the
swords.
Gun swords, and the gun goes in the holster.
And knives that actually go in the boot.
Knives that go in the boot. So it was Flash, Dale, Ming, and Zarkov?
Yep.
Is that what it was? Okay. And again, very much like the Alex Raymond strips. Yeah. They're beautiful. I don't actually have any of those. I've always wanted to track those down someday.
I do have those. I have a loose set of the Mattel figures. I think the thing that disappoints me about the Mattel figures is the character choices are a little strange. Captain Arak, really? Dale was excluded.
Aura was excluded.
Baron was excluded. Baron.
And then Aura and her team of warrior women. They, like, rode those ostrich-type creatures.
Yeah.
Do you remember that?
Yeah, I do, absolutely.
That would have been cool. And for me, worst of all, was the Metal Men. The censors were so uptight about violence back then. Like, you couldn't – it wasn't until, like, some of the G.I. Joe animated stuff in the early 80s you could throw a punch.
Yeah.
Like, Thundar, the writers of Thundar always talked about they had to come up with new and unusual ways to fight people. And if you look at the Flash Gordon animated series, there's tackling – there's tripping. He's taking big, stone, hunks of stone that came out of the wall, sliding it across the floor to trip someone, things like that. So there was, sword fight, here and there, but they couldn't do any of the fisticuffs. So they invented the Metal Men so that if there was some kind of violence and then even those times, they don't necessarily zap the Metal Men with their guns. They might throw water over them.
Yeah.
To get them to spark and crumble.
But you're right, they were a cool design.
Super cool design.
Yeah.
You know, their guns, their bodies, just the way they moved was really cool. So yeah, I always was disappointed. I always just got disappointed that they in a very sci-fi move, they gave Flash silver boots. And that always bugged me. So when I, you know, years later when I got duplicates of the characters, I painted his boots black like they should have been.
You know how many extra figures they sold because of those shiny boots?
How many?
None.
No.
Yeah.
No. But you know, for me, it was just like, I can't believe this. I could actually go out, get these Flash Gordon figures and watch the show on a Saturday morning. Like, that was just spectacular to me.
I wasn't able to do that. They didn't sell those in Canada.
Oh, they didn't?
No.
Oh. Well, they're gorgeous. So I'm just eating this stuff up with up with a spoon, because it's 1979 when this show airs, and I am just, like I say, I am glued to the television. I do my Bugs Bunny and, you know, what have you early, and then I know at a certain time flip to NBC and there is going to be Flash Gordon.
Did you have any problem with it? Because I seem to recall it was on later in the day, and I can remember, like, 11 o'clock was a real danger hour because I was going to get kicked out. You know, like, I never saw much Flash Gordon, or sorry, Fat Albert either, because, you know, once it started to get close to noon, my folks would be like, stop watching TV, go out and play.
I think it was, I remember it being on a little bit later.
Yeah, I can remember vividly going shopping with my grandmother at the mall. And she was doing something or other, and I was watching Flash Gordon on a little tiny TV in the TV section.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, like it was this little handheld color TV, and I'd never seen a TV that small before.
Well, I remember that it was kind of, you know, once Flash Gordon was done, you might have one or two other things to watch, and then it was going to get into things like, you know, Hot Hero Sandwich, or one of those, you know, wacky shows with, like, you know, live action people doing comedy skits and teaching you stuff.
Yeah.
The cartoons were kind of done. So it was kind of the end of the morning. And then, you know, you got on your day and did whatever you did. So I don't know, you know, which came first, chicken or egg here. But at the time, I'm also into Queen, the band Queen. You know, my cousin was kind of into them. My brother Gino would listen to them when they were on the radio. I think he had a couple of the records. And, you know, around this time, Another One Bites the Dust is everywhere. I mean, you can't walk out the door and not get hit in the face with Another One Bites the Dust. It's everywhere. And then Crazy Little Thing Called Love, the next single. And so, you know, I'm at the age where I'm starting to buy cassettes. You know, I've gotten vinyl. Might as well start getting cassettes for my little, you know, tape recorder. I mean, I'm 9, but, you know, I'm kind of hip. Mm-hmm. And I got The Game. I bought with some, you know, work money or yard money or whatever. I went out and got The Game on cassette, played that nonstop. And so they were kind of my band. I'm still into, you know, McCartney and Wings and, you know, The Cars and all kinds of groups. But Queen were kind of, I knew who they were, and I knew We Are the Champions and some of the stuff that came before. But this is what really, you know, really hit me with these guys.
Yeah.
So, I don't know which came first, hearing any of the Queen stuff or Flash Gordon or seeing a trailer or what, but I think it was being in the movie theater, walking through the lobby and seeing a poster for Flash Gordon and that classic. I never saw the advance poster, which is a gorgeous Mylar, you know, pre-production painting of all these Hawkmen zeroing in on, like, Ming's shuttle. They're all about to attack it. Mm-hmm. That was the advance. This was the actual poster with, you know, done by Amsel, you know, the famous poster of, you know, Flash holding the sword and Dale behind and that big Ming above them saying, pathetic earthlings, you know, who can save you now? And I just did this triple take, like, what? And I don't know if I noticed it on the poster that the music was by Queen or what it was, but I think my cousin David picked up the album. And he started playing the record, and my head came off. Like, it was just, how could this be happening? How could this group that I love so much be doing music for? Wait, they're doing a live action version of Flash Gordon, you know? So I was familiar with the album before I even saw the movie.
Yeah.
And the movie, I think, in the U.S. was like a December release.
Yeah, I remember it. It had to be. It had to be because I remember I was in the fifth grade, and my classroom got switched midstream because there was like 45 kids in my class, and they threw half of us in a portable. And I knew where I know where I was when I saw Flash Gordon because it really hit me hard, that movie. I don't know. I guess it was the doldrums after Empire Strikes Back, but I can honestly remember where I was when I saw it. And I think before the movie came out, I read about it in the Electric Company magazine.
Oh, that's cool.
They had Sam Jones on the cover. I remember that.
I also remember a kid down the block who I've mentioned before, Mark Pakulski, who was 2 years older than me, but he was just one of those kids that got everything. If a movie was coming out, he got the thing first. If a toy line was coming out, he had every figure. So I had some stuff, but I would get to go down to his house and see what really existed because he had everything.
Yeah, we had that kid. His name was Donnie in our neighborhood.
Yeah, same kid.
Yeah.
And I seem to recall, and this might have even been before the movie, him having the storybook, the Flash Gordon storybook by Golden, or Whitman or whatever it was, and then the comic book adaptation.
That thing is gorgeous, and I found out about it when I was like 30.
It's beautiful. It's by what's his name? Not Alex Raymond, but
I know who you're talking about.
The two guys. The thing is too,
Didn't they do the Star Wars strip as well?
Right away, they did the Star Wars strip. Archie Goodwin, Al Williamson.
Al Williamson and Archie Goodwin, yes.
They did the adaptation for Empire, which I had.
Did you know that the Golden also did Clash of the Titans as a comic?
I think I did, yes.
I just saw that the other day and was like, well, how did I miss all this crap, you know?
Well, their artwork is his stuff is so distinctive, and when I saw it at my friend at Mark Bukowski's, I'm like, this is the same guy that did Empire. Like you can tell because you know at times it looks like Harrison Ford, but it's kind of his version of Harrison Ford. Mm-hmm. At times it looks like Sam Jones, but it's kind of you know. But
well, I think a lot of those guys are working from stills when they can. You could really see it in old Gold Key Star Trek comics.
Yeah, they're working off of stills and stuff, but they're trying to get it as accurate as they can, but they're also, you know, trying to inject some of their style into it. They can't help it. Like, you know it's Ming. Sometimes it's Max von Sydow Ming, and sometimes it's just his Ming kind of. But I'm just eating these books up, and I got to see it, got to see it, got to see it. And then my brother took me the first time, and I was blown away by this movie. I mean, I was blown away. I was a little disturbed, and it was a little strange to me because I was expecting more fisticuffs and more, you know, him to be a little tougher than he was or be more two-dimensional than he was. And it was definitely dirty. I mean, it definitely had like dirty, sexy kind of aspects to it that I had never seen before. There's kind of an S&M vibe that runs through this movie. You know, and some you know eroticism that's like you know even the way Ming deals with his daughter and her getting tortured and you know Clytus being into it you know there's some weirdness and just how overt Aura is in wanting Flash, but I loved it and I loved it too because I think I must have seen it four or five times in the theater that and I stand by this today you know. Star Wars did something extraordinary. People talk about it in the design aspect of it, and they still talk about it, in that for the first time, in a really authentic way, we were getting a sci-fi world that was very lived in, that wasn't, you know, shiny computers and gleaming corridors. You felt like, you know, Solo had been flying the Falcon for quite a few years.
They
dirtied up the models, the interiors, everything. It made you feel like this world existed. And of course, most of what came after that in that same realm tried to emulate it. To me, culminating in something like, you know, Alien certainly did it. Ridley Scott talks about using Star Wars as a blueprint for it. But culminating in something like Blade Runner that is so specific and so off the deep end gorgeous in the way it depicted the future that you know, those things have all become signposts for other people to riff on. And Blade Runner, they've tried to I can't tell you how many different people have tried to get close to the vibe of Blade Runner and it still looks like a Blade Runner ripoff. When I look at Flash Gordon, I truly don't think – I think it doesn't – I don't think it looks like anything else that's come before or since.
It goes the other way. And I was going to touch on this. You know, I was probably 10 when I saw it, maybe 11. When, 1980?
It came out in 1980, yeah.
Yeah, I was 10. And it was like the perfect cocktail. It's a bit cartoony.
Yep.
It's visually amazing. You've got this over-the-top, amazing rock opera anthem to it. And, you know, the actors are all playing it straight.
Yep.
And the film is actually quite – I love that movie. And, you know, like it's a good film. And it really left a huge mark on me.
Well, it also – I mean, we should go back to this because this is what's so extraordinary and bizarre and lovable about it, I think. All the things you're describing, there are so many reasons it shouldn't work. And listen, let's be honest. For a good chunk of people out there, it doesn't work. There are some people, you know, at the time and since that look at it and think it's just a big mess and it's too campy and it's too silly. And yes, there's camp in it. But if you think about the way this thing was made, you know, Dina De Laurentiis always wanted to do – first off, let's turn the Wayback Machine back a little further. And this is what makes it even more wacky. Mm-hmm. You know – when Luke is finished, and again, I'm telling a story I'm sure all the listeners know, but just to revamp here, when Luke is finished American Graffiti, that was a big movie. That made a lot of bread, and he could kind of do whatever he wanted. But even before he did American Graffiti, he wanted to do a sci-fi kind of epic. And if he couldn't do his own original thing, he wanted to do Flash Gordon. So he initially approached King Features about doing a big budget Flash Gordon. And for whatever the reasons were, they couldn't meet up on percentages or whatever it was, he walked away and he ends up making Star Wars and changes the face of cinema and merchandising and all that stuff. And so now everyone's scrambling for another Star Wars. And I suppose when Dino De Laurentiis came to King Features, they probably were a lot more amenable to make something. So this thing is finally happening because, you know, because of Star Wars. Like, imagine if it had gone the other way, basically. So this big Italian producer gets it. I think it's shot in England. A lot of the crew is Italian. A lot of the designers are Italian. You know, I want to say Danilo Donati was like the set designer, either sets or costume. He'd worked with Fellini for years on many of Fellini's projects. So, you know, when you see Aura, she's pulling along that little person, and she says, "Come along, Fellini."
Yeah. Oh, right.
That's
yeah.
A little wink to Fellini, you know. And so he says, "Well, you know, I'm not going to do the accent, but you know, he's saying it's fun. It's a comic strip, but we got to have this, we got to have that, you know." And he's thinking of all these things, and he just thinks of the visuals. He's just thinking about how gorgeous this comic book looks. You know,
he'd already done that with Diabolik.
With Diabolik, it came right out of the strip. You know, he's thinking much more visually. But if you had any reference to anything that was comic book that had been done up to that point, you either had the Richard Donner Superman film,
yep,
and you'd have to go after those guys, but they were pretty busy doing their thing, or you had the Batman TV show. And you know, just
and they weren't working right now.
But you could understand why he would kind of lean that way, because it's very pop art. There was a very pop art European sensibility to a lot of the design in that original Batman series. It's,
you know what? The exact same thing happened in the 90s. Everybody was either trying to take Tim Burton's formula for superhero movies, even when it didn't work. Or they were actually trying to get Tim Burton to do any comic book movie they could.
That's right.
You know, he doesn't necessarily going to make the greatest Superman movie.
Exactly. So he gets a hold of Lorenzo Semple Jr., mm-hmm. who was responsible for – I think he wrote lots of stuff. In fact, I think he might have written 3 Days of the Condor. I may be wrong about that. But he did a lot of stuff in the 70s too. But
didn't,
you know,
he write the King Kong script?
I think he wrote the King Kong script. But yeah. he got him because of his love for the Batman series.
Yeah.
So Lorenzo Semple Jr. comes along and it's kind of like, well, you must have called me for a reason. You must love the Batman. You're doing a comic strip movie. Batman, you know, what do you want? And he says the first meeting he had, he knew they were in trouble, where De Laurentiis introduced him to this woman who was the translator who was going to translate his script. And he said she was holding a little like chihuahua in her arms. And she says to Semple, she says, Do you like my new cat? And Lorenzo Simba said it was a dog. And the fact that, that she'd got that mixed up did not bode well for how this script was going to go. So anyway, it's loaded with camp. It's loaded with great jokes, some over the top, some kind of subtle. But it's definitely played with its tongue in its cheek. And then, on the other hand, there are some moments that are deadly serious and scary. And, you know, Ming's speech of, you know, pathetic earthlings, you know, hurling your bodies out into the void without the slightest inkling of what's waiting for you out there. If you had any inkling of the true nature of the universe, you would have hid from it in terror. You know, things like that are really, they don't exactly jive with Flash Gordon, quarterback, New York Jets, you know, yeah. Like, you know, being winked at. So it always kind of felt like an odd fit to me, but I ate it up because the music was so, no one had ever done that, to have that kind of a score for this kind of a movie had never been done. It just gets you on your feet. The cast itself, which is interesting too, like you've got a slightly international cast, like Mariangela Melato plays Kala. She was a big Italian actress. You've got Max von Sydow, couldn't be more perfect as Ming.
Oh, yeah.
Peter Wingard. Now, Peter Wingard was a big actor in the 50s and 60s, and especially you can see him all throughout British television in the 60s. Every Avengers.
Jason King was his thing, right?
And then he was in a show called Department S, and his character Jason King was so popular, and the ladies loved him so much. He got his own series. I mean, we should got to put a picture up of Jason King.
I absolutely will. I had a Jason King book as a kid.
Oh, you're kidding me.
Yeah, I don't know why I had it.
Have you heard the Jason King album?
Yes. Yes. You had me YouTube that once.
Yeah, that's something. So, but here's the thing. Peter Wingard, and Peter Wingard's got this amazing voice. I mean, he is
great delivery too.
Unbelievable delivery, but one of the best theatrical voices you'll ever hear. But after the whole Jason King madness in the mid 70s, he got in trouble. He got arrested in the UK for soliciting in a men's room, basically.
Yeah.
And he didn't work much. It was hard for him to get work. The next major thing he did, and it resuscitated his career, thanks to Mike Hodges, was playing Clytus in Flash Gordon. Now, the kicker was he's in a mask the whole time, but it was a big part for him because he hadn't done much work since the arrest to do it. Timothy Dalton, of course, was a very well-known Shakespearean actor at that point in film and television. This is pre-Bond, but he was wonderful, perfect as Prince Baron. Melody Anderson as Dale. And then this near complete unknown, best known being Bo Derek's boyfriend in 10, like the year before, Sam J. Jones comes along to play Flash Gordon. And, you know, Alex Ross and I have talked about this. Alex is a guy that, you know, not to get, you know, kooky on you, but, you know, he's a guy that gets uptight about every way they design the neck on every bat suit, you know, or the glove should have been this, it could have been this, it should have been better. So he looks at things with those eyes.
That's
just Sam Jones as Flash Gordon and says, you know, there has never been a better depiction of the heroic male, the heroic, you know, everyman comic book kind of male in a movie than Sam Jones. And he towers over everyone in the film. He's huge. It's a one-dimensional part, unfortunately, and there's not a lot for him to do. But every image of him, he just looks like Flash Gordon. He looks like he would be that. I mean, I'm sorry, no offense to Gil Gerard or whatever, but put him next to Gil Gerard as a comic strip character, and Flash Gordon beats the crap out of him. Now, this is another little bit of trivia for everybody that's been talked about for 30 some years with this movie. His voice in the movie.
Yeah.
It's pretty clear that his voice is dubbed.
But it does sound like Sam Jones.
Well, kind of. Here's a little bit of trivia for you. Two things. One, he, very much in a George Lazenby kind of way, he and his management agents, whatever, got really uptight with the producers about a number of things, which I believe resulted in him not coming back to do Looping,
the
film. So I'd say a good 75% of that film is some other actor dubbing in his lines, and I can tell from the sounds, I can tell, you know, being doing voiceover and studying this shit, that it's a British guy doing an American accent.
Whoever this guy. You have a sensitive ear to that.
Now, because he'll say things like, "Don't worry, Dale. We'll all wake up, and this is just going to be a bad dream."
Yeah.
You know, like, nobody talks that way. It's just he's trying too hard to put a little curve.
There is a strange quality to that voice. I've noticed that too.
When he gets to Arboria, and, you know, Aura takes him to Arboria, and she says, "Go on, I'm gonna go talk to Baron. Everything's gonna be okay." And he hangs back with the guard. She does something, and, you know, Baron doesn't trust her, whatever. And when he turns around, he looks at the guard, and he says, "Does anybody trust her twice?" From that moment on, all of the Arboria stuff, that's Sam Jones' real voice.
Yeah, I think that's the thing that throws a lot of people off, is it comes in and out.
It comes in and out, and it's definitely him. You know, when he's like, "Back off, one more move, and you'll be looking for a new prince." He's got sort of a tiny bit of a southern twang.
Yeah, yeah, it's more obvious on, like, The Highwayman or other things where he's just kind of playing himself.
Right.
Yeah.
So that's definitely him in there. And you know, it just, you know, every bit of it just got more outrageous. The colors are fantastic. The effects, that thing that did with the liquid sky. And I didn't know this at the time, but, you know, the guy that directed it is called Mike Hodges. And the big thing he directed before this that I've become one of my favorite movies was a 1971 film called Get Carter.
I love Get Carter.
Which is Michael Caine in going back to Newcastle. His brother's been killed. He wants to find out why, and he just goes on an absolute killing rampage to find out what happened to his brother.
And it was remade, but just see the original.
Just see the original. It's so good. The soundtrack is fantastic.
The soundtrack, I believe, is the same fella who did the theme. Oh, never mind. I can't remember his name.
His name will come to me in a minute, but it's Get Carter. Oh, it's once you hear a guy's
Alan
name.
Alan Hawkshaw.
Yeah, it's not Alan Hawkshaw.
Oh, no, it's not Alan Hawkshaw?
No, because he died kind of young, this guy, I think. And
I'm getting them mixed up then. Roy Budd.
Roy Budd.
Yeah.
It's Roy Budd. Great soundtrack by Roy Budd. Career best performance by Michael Caine. But you wouldn't think that the guy that did that would come up and do Flash Gordon. So you just, all these things in a pot, you just go, okay, we'll get the British guy that did Get Carter. We've got an international cast. We're going to have Italian people working on it, you know, shoot it in England. And then what's missing? We got to get a soundtrack. How about Queen? Biggest band of it. You know, for so many reasons, it shouldn't work. And it does. And it was a big movie in Europe and Japan. It did very, very well. It did not do well in the U.S., I always hoped we were going to get a sequel. We never did.
Never got any merchandise either.
And no merchandise. So that's another thing. I'm that kid that's going to the toy store, grabbing up all the Flash Gordon toys. And every movie that comes out has got a toy line. So there's got to be a toy line for Flash Gordon, right? Well, I spend the next 6 months to a year checking the toy stores with nothing. You know, not to jump around too much, but fast forward to our adult lives, and I since discover that this is just about all that's come out for Flash Gordon. A set of puffy stickers, a beautiful metal and plastic cap gun by Lone Star, British company, in a gorgeous display box. Weetabix, the cereal, did trading cards inside the boxes. And if you got all the trading cards, got your whole set, you could mail away for an album, a stamp album to stick them in, which I managed to track all of that stuff down. I found a completed album years ago for a pretty penny on eBay. Some buttons I think were made. And a couple of Halloween costumes. I think a Flash Gordon and a Hawkman costume were made in the U.S. I've since found a Prince Baron play outfit from Italy, in very strange Italian packaging, but it claimed that there were other characters made, and that's about it. That's all that got made for this movie.
Yeah, I'm not sure. Very disappointing. The only thing I ran out and bought as a kid, and it may have been the first non-Power Records purchase I made was the album, the Queen soundtrack.
Well, you did.
I bought that. I still have it.
What was cool about that for us too, it's more annoying to me now as an adult, but as kids, is that somebody, and they've talked to Brian May and Roger Taylor about it, can't decide on whose idea it was to actually include snippets of dialogue in between the tracks telling the story.
I don't know, but that worked for me. Cause, you know,
do you remember that?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I can still remember Dale's "I'm Just a New York City Girl."
Yeah, it's a lot of stuff in there. And I also say, not only is it a brilliant soundtrack with some beautiful stuff in there, the theme tune, of course, "I've Got Everything Queen I've Ever Done." The closing credit song is called "The Hero." And it is, I want this thing played at my funeral because it is one of the, it is so, the drums, the way the drums kick in, and Freddie's voices never sound better. And it's the best track on the entire record for the entire film. So if anybody's going to watch Flash Gordon for the first time because this, sit through the end credits, you will not be disappointed at the music you're going to hear. So all that's going on. Loving this movie, and it starts a whole love for Flash Gordon. So I start not just picking up pieces that I missed from the Mattel line, you know, carded versions or, you know, boxed versions of the ships and stuff. I start looking into, you know, the rack toys and odds and ends that sort of were out and about. You and I meet in a very strange way. I had just spent 2 days poring over the Plaid Stallions site. I don't even know how I found you guys. But I was obsessed. I mean, I just literally spent like 2 days rummaging through these amazing pages of gold. And I sent you a note. This is what, 5 years ago, something like that?
5 or 6 years ago, yeah. I remember that note. Because
I sent you a note. What?
I went to a Comic Con that weekend, and I think I picked up a Ming.
And I said, and in my note, I said, you know, I love your site. It's so cool. It's right up my alley. Let me tell you who I am and what I've done. Maybe you've heard of these toys or not, but isn't that cool? Because we definitely are into the same stuff. And your response was, "Oh, you're no kidding! I just picked up some of your Flash Gordon toys last weekend."
Yeah, I went to a dismal Comic Con, and I didn't, you know, I was just wandering around, and one guy I think just had the Ming, or maybe the Flash and the Ming. I can't remember. I just remember, and I was like, "Oh yeah, I missed these. I'm gonna grab these."
Well, the fun story. Just to give you a quick background on the Flash Gordon toys, when I kicked off Big Bang Pow in 2005, 2006, this is a story I've told several times. It was because I wanted to, you know, see if I could make toys that no one had ever made. You know, I thought, how hard can it be, sort of thing. But that's another story altogether. But the first thing that really got me excited and I really pursued was this British series called Spaced that Simon Pegg and Jessica Stevenson did with Nick Frost and Mark Heap and a bunch of other folks, each episode directed by Edgar Wright. This is before Shaun of the Dead came out. The show is just marvelous. It's kind of like the antithesis to a show like Friends. These guys are all losers. They're all geeks kind of wandering aimlessly, and it's loaded with pop culture references and sci-fi and horror movie references and stuff in every episode. And I just love the show. And I spent over a year back and forthing with, you know, Paramount Comedy Channel and Channel 4 and Big Talk, who were the production company for the show, never being able to determine who had the rights to this and how we were going to do it. But this was my obsession. Meanwhile, I'm trying to put the company together, trying to figure out if I do it, how am I going to do this and what are they going to look like? We get designs drawn up. And I start thinking, well, I better look at my short list of other properties if and when this thing ever happens, so I get these other things going. And I start using the leverage that this deal is about to happen with the other people that I'm calling. Because, of course, the first thing they want to know is, who are you? Do you have a toy company? What have you done? How is this going to work exactly? Because I was calling cold, you know, saying I wanted to do these things. Mm-hmm. And I would use Spaced as a bit of leverage. And luckily, when I got to a guy at Paramount, he had reference because of Shaun of the Dead was going to get distributed in the U.S. through Paramount. So when I was talking to him about Lebowski, it all started to kind of come together. And he was like, oh, you're doing that? Oh, that's cool. Yeah, I think I know about space. I haven't seen it, but I know about Shaun of the Dead. It's going to be big. It's going to be huge. And the Lebowski deal started to kind of come through and started to happen. While that was happening, I'm attacking King Features to try to get Flash Gordon. And the real funny story about this is, and this went on for 6-8 months, getting in touch with King Features, I was talking to some of the people that did the deal, the licensing deal for the film, when it came out. They're still at King Features, okay? And they're convinced, beyond a shadow of a doubt, they don't have licensing rights. That for the movie, you have to go to Universal and get licensing rights. Okay, are you sure? Because every piece of merchandise I have says King Features Syndicate on the – no, Universal did the movie. You got to go to them to get the rights. That's what it is. that took me forever to get that answer. Then going to get Universal's answer took forever. They're convinced King Features is crazy. No, we don't have – we put the movie out. We're putting the movie out on DVD and we can do this and that. But they don't have – this went on for 8 months until I finally had to get the people at Universal to dig up 25-year-old paperwork, get it copied and sent over to King Features to say, we do not have rights. King Features owned the character and were convinced they didn't have the rights to do anything with that film. So that all gets sorted. We finally get the paperwork going. And I say one thing for sure. This is the last straw. You got to make sure that every character that you have a likeness for has to be in that license. You know, in other words, because Topol, for some reason in 1980, would not sign his likeness away. Has to be in the paperwork. And sure enough, when the paperwork showed up, none of that was in there.
Doesn't that make you want a Topol Dr. Zarkov figure just on principle?
Oh, it totally does. I want them all. We wanted this thing to go so much further. So we're doing all this. And as all this madness is happening, and it's trying to get together, I'm down at Comic-Con making the announcement about spaced action figures. It's Comic-Con 2005 or 2006, I forget. And from my vantage point at the booth that I'm at, the Entertainment Earth booth, you can stand at the front of that booth and look across the floor, still to this day, the Alex Ross booth is right across the way. And the reason it caught my eye was the banner hanging above it is his name.
The Flash Gordon.
Of the Flash Gordon logo.
Yeah.
I had read not 3 months before in some article in Wizard magazine, they asked him, give us your top 10 or top 20 one sheets of all time. And his number one was Flash Gordon because it's his favorite movie of all time. And so I thought, I don't know this guy. I know his work. Never met him. I wonder if I walked over there right now and talked to him, and told him about this action figure thing. And I talked to his manager. And manager tells the story a year later, like, you don't know how many people come up to me and give me a business card and they, I got to do this. I want to show Alex this. Do you think Alex could show up for this? And it happens every year. And he said, you said the magic words, Flash Gordon movie. I remember him looking at me, he goes, oh, the movie? You're talking about wanting to do action for you for the movie? Oh, you got it. You've got to talk to Alex. You got to talk to Alex. And that was like in July. And by November, I'm in a car heading to my brother's house in Scarsdale, and the phone rings, and it's Alex Ross. And we've been friends, you know, ever since that phone call. And he ended up getting on board doing design work for our Flash Gordon action figures.
And how did it come to be that I have a special edition of the DVD with artwork by Ross? Well, did you do some introductions there?
Yes, I did.
You're a good man, sir.
I was working on a production thing. I was helping a buddy out with, believe it or not, an Annie biography of Patrick Duffy.
Oh, that must have been a special time.
And we're pulling out the
step-by-step episodes.
Man from Atlantis comic books and, you know, all kinds of stuff. And I get a phone call on my cell phone because I'd come into Universal to meet about other projects, other properties that we had with them, like Big Lebowski. And there had been phone calls floating around about Flash Gordon and the paperwork getting to King Features. And someone calls me and says, we're thinking about re-releasing Flash Gordon onto DVD. What do you think if we did that? We'd love to have you come in and tell us why you think it's a good idea.
Neat.
And of course, I'm like, of course, because my big, you know, part of the problem with Spaced was always going to be no one knows it in the U.S. The DVDs aren't out yet. Part of the problem with Flash Gordon always was if Best Buy or somebody, you know, or Suncoast that were around back then wanted to do a special pack-in for a DVD, the DVD is in moratorium. It hasn't been out for 10 years. So this will be perfect. This will be a perfect way, as good as a new film, to launch our action figures with. And I went in and had a meeting with them and told them all the reasons that, and I said, we could do a documentary. You could get me. I'll produce the thing, go to the actors. I could find these people. They want to do it. We'll do a sit down. They had all kinds of plans they wanted me to do. And then eventually she pulls out this piece of promo art that we had at Comic-Con, which was an original piece that Alex had drawn of Sam sort of swinging the sword. It's not an official piece because he can't sell it. It's just a piece that he has. And we stuck the logo on it, and they said, well, like, clearly you're familiar with Alex Ross or friendly with Alex Ross. And I said, yes. And they wanted me to do introductions between Ross and the studio to do a special cover, which I was happy to do because it's one off his bucket list that he's like, I get to do an official, you know, movie poster type thing for Flash Gordon. And then, of course, they got a crew out to Chicago and interviewed him for the DVD for an extra. And I managed to February 2007 Toy Fair, Blizzard Madness, I grabbed the prototype we had of Flash and Ming, stuck them in a FedEx, they're one of a kind, stuck them in a FedEx box, shipped them to Alex overnight because the next day the crew were coming to interview him. So I wanted them to at least get him at his workstation, you know, working on one of the figures so he could mention it and, like, it's come full circle. Now we're doing toys kind of thing. Because he used to take his Mego Superman, you know, the 12-inch Superman that looked like Christopher Reeve.
Yep.
He would take a lot of his figures and make them into custom Flash Gordon figures. And he took that Mego Superman and made it into a Prince Baron. He took construction paper, made a green top, put a black mustache with, like, you know, duct tape on his lip. And he had his version of Prince Baron.
That's really cool, actually.
Yeah, now he gets to make the figure. So that's a funny little thing there about the DVD getting released. And they've always shortchanged it on Blu-ray. There's all kinds of making of stuff. Somebody got a making of into my lap that's like a 15-minute thing that's incredible with design footage and construction footage and interviews with the whole cast. And I went to Universal and said, how about this? Stick this on. Yeah, we just don't know where it came from. It's like, well, if it was made in 1980 on the set of the movie, you guys own it. Trust me. Just put it on there. And they didn't. So all kinds
lawyers,
of
that. Lawyers ruin everything, don't they?
Yeah, they do. But I find as the years go on that more and more I do have that secret handshake experience with Flash Gordon, the 1980 film, that more and more people are getting into it. It's seeping into pop culture more, not as a joke, but as an awesome thing and a cool thing. What was the Will Ferrell movie with he's a figure skater?
Oh, Blades of Glory?
Blades of Glory. The climactic showdown for that, you know, the skate showdown, they use the Flash thong song, the theme.
Mm-hmm. And they use the Ming Ring sound in Scott Pilgrim.
Use the Ming Ring sound because
they used to use the sound of that was excellent, Brian. The little ball, the laser that comes out of it.
Yeah.
Every day on Q107, this radio station I live with, and I think they used it for like Here Comes the Classic Rock, you know, whatever it was, but they used that for at least a decade after the movie came out.
And so when you see things like that, when I see things like that being used in Blades of Glory, and I consider who's involved with it, my brain switches on and goes, that wasn't a mistake. Someone didn't just go, here's five music cues, pick one. Somebody sought that out.
Oh,
somebody
yeah.
Somebody loves that song. The ring used in Scott Pilgrim, you know, that is a very specific, you know, a friend of mine went to a midnight screening, asked that very question of Edgar Wright because it became a bit of a midnight cult thing in LA for a while. He said, how much did it cost you to get the kids? Like $15,000 just to get that sound effect license. But I wanted it so badly. You know, he takes Timothy Dalton and puts him in Hot Fuzz. And I got to see a screening at the New Beverly. They did a screening at one of Edgar Wright's film festivals. They screened Flash Gordon. And Timothy Dalton was there for Q&A before and after the movie, which was awesome, with Edgar Wright. And he remembers when Edgar was talking, he said, "Can you grow the Flash Gordon mustache?" And Timothy Dalton said, "Well, I can certainly grow a mustache in time for filming." And he was like, no, it's got to be the Prince Baron Flash Gordon mustache. You've got to have the Baron mustache. And he wasn't even sure what he meant, but he went back and looked at the film and, you know, did what he wanted. But that's how much Edgar Wright loves this thing. You know, Alex Ross talks about it as, you know, influencing so much of the work that he's done. It's that important of a movie. And you start to see it, you know, like, I see it much more in the UK being referenced, and many, many more t-shirts and things like that happening.
It's got a thing in the UK, especially Brian Blessed's performance, which is, you know, if anybody's kind of camping it up a bit, it's Blessed, but it's so awesome and over the top that he just works, because the character is supposed to be boisterous.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because even when you watch the old serials, the Voltan on that is just chewing scenery too. You know,
I think it's that second lease of life, you know, for him too, where he did the voice of a sat nav system in the UK, and I'm sure it's because he played Voltan. Yeah. You know, I ended up, I think I might have told you once, doing an auction years ago. It was an auction, an ad in SFX magazine about this auction for AIDS research, and each one of these, you know, 5x7 or 8x10, whatever it was, white cards was a drawing and an autograph by a different sci-fi person. And the one they showed in the ad, I kid you not, in the ad was done by Brian Blessed. He had drawn himself as Voltan, like a little round face and a big bushy beard. And the little line came out of his mouth and it said, "Gordon's alive," in big letters. And I saw it and I thought, I got to get in on this auction. And the auction was going to, by the time I got to the internet, the auction was going to be over in a day. But I won it. I won that one by Terrence Stamp, one by James Earl Jones, and then I won the Voltan one. That's Brian Blessed doing
it. Oh, you won that? That's cool.
As Voltan. Yeah, I won all three of those. And then the extraordinary thing happens. Art toys come out. People love them. I get people all the time saying, "I can't believe you did that. You know, I've been waiting for that my whole life." And it's, again, that weird full circle thing where you go, well, these are the toys I wanted in the toy stores and didn't get, you know, when I was 9 or 10 years old. Now they're finally happening. We managed to do 2 different Flash Gordons, 2 different Mings, a Dale in a dress, Prince Baron, Clytus, and
Clytus with his eyeball sticking out, which Clytus, is a scene that really had an impact on a 10-year-old.
Yeah, that was creepy violent to me. It was kind of disturbing. Like, he was made of liquid and stuff. We did a Flash Gordon in the t-shirt, and we had so many more plans. We wanted to do a set of die-cast ships, kind of like Corgi, you know, like Corgi size, of a couple of the shuttles. I wanted to do a build-a-figure thing where you could build the base that he and Baron fought on with the spikes.
Yeah.
But it got to be a very expensive process. But anyway, so we're doing all that stuff, and it's still a fixture in my life. I still love it. I still get every version that's come out, every version of the CD, you name it. And then a while ago, about a year ago, I start getting emails from a guy that finds me. I forget how he found me, telling me he's been working with a modeler on making a full-scale for our action figures – full-scale model of the rocket sled from Flash Gordon. And it's getting very expensive. And, you know, long story short, he wants to keep it. He's going to have a second and third one made, one for me, one for Alex Ross. It all falls apart. This guy spent so much time on this. He went from like one or two or three different modelers were going to do this. They all fell through. He finally gets one made. Finally gets one made for himself. And the guy that's doing it for him tells him that he's actually working on a full-scale model right now for a movie. And I read this email going, what? He goes, yeah, it's some movie with Mark Wahlberg. And this was a long time ago, and I thought, this has got to be – someone's getting their wires crossed somewhere. Anyway, I end up buying the model, and it's absolutely stunning and extraordinary and huge, so that I haven't got it in my case yet. It's still in the closet, but it's gorgeous. And it turns out the movie he's talking about is Ted.
Yeah.
Now, did you know, did you see it before you knew what was in there, or did you know about it after, or what?
I think I saw a commercial before the film came out where they were watching Flash Gordon and talking about it, and I immediately texted you and said, have you seen the Ted preview? And you kind of were like, oh, you're not the first person to tell me about that. But yeah, I had an inkling there was something, and I always knew Seth MacFarlane had an obsession with Flash Gordon because he threw a lot of Flash Gordon gags into Family Guy. The one that I liked best was something about they were in trouble, and they said, well, where's God when you need him? And they show God on the rocket sled. And but yeah, I was slightly aware of Sam Jones being in it. Yeah,
I didn't know. I mean, I heard about it through people, and then once the movie came out, I must have got a dozen texts within that week saying, "Oh my God, you've got to see Ted." You got to see him. Yes, I heard and know about it. And then I saw it, and I liked the movie. I think there's some really cute and yeah, there's some raunchy stuff, but there's some warm and fun stuff in the movie too. And just it's kind of hard not to laugh at this little teddy bear. But when it gets to the Flash Gordon stuff, again, my mind was just blown. I just sat there watching it, going, I can't believe there's somebody else out there that loves this movie as much as we do, and that is literally, you know, picked up the phone and called Sam Jones. He must have gone, you're going to do what now?
Yeah.
And now he's going to be in the sequel. So apparently he's even moving on to the sequel.
And what kills me too is that Sam Jones is the antithesis of what he's like in real life. Just from really talking to you, that he's a pretty straight edge dude. And
he's definitely found a path, you know, whether it's religion or whatever. And he's very straight laced. He's got a couple of kids. You know, they were down at Comic-Con one year to do a signing at the Entertainment Earth booth. He couldn't have been nicer, you know, to me. He's a big guy. He's still in great shape and a big dude. And his kids were delightful. I walked around with his kids for a bit. And Melody, too. Like the year before that, you know, we found out that Sam and Melody were up sweating their guts out upstairs in the autograph area. And we sort of invited them down and said, why don't you come on down here? We've got stuff you can sign, or you can, you know, bring your stuff here and be a nice promo. Because at that point, we'd only had the prototypes up.
Yeah.
So I got some pictures with the both of them, and it was, you know, it was very strange. It becomes very surreal that you're standing there. It happened with Sam and Melody, and not to mention Melody looked terrific. I, you know, had a bit of a crush on her.
Yeah, I've seen photos of her. She looks great.
She looks great. You know, I've done it with Richard Hatch and Dirk Benedict.
You did it with them, eh?
I did it with all of them. They have to if they want to be at the booth.
Right.
They have to do it with me. Shatner, you know, where these strange, you know, things collide in the universe where you go, you know, this isn't – how is it that you're not – you're making stuff. You're help making stuff based on these characters that you didn't get when you were a kid. And now you're standing with the actors portraying them. And the world gets really small, and you just kind of go, you know, the 8-year-old Jason wouldn't have believed it. He just would have kicked you in the shins if you told him this was going to happen.
You know what? I saw Sam Jones at San Diego Comic Con when I was there, and it's probably around the time you and I probably bumped into each other there, but just didn't, you know who each other were. But that's when he was upstairs too, and I avoided meeting him, and I avoided meeting him because I just had that. I've had mixed results with meeting idols.
Yeah.
And I didn't want to meet him and have him be David Prowse, to be nice, because he was a real royal dick to me. but you know, it's just one of those things where I got kind of nervous. And in fact, I go to a lot of shows with celebrities, and I rarely bug them unless it's somebody like the last celebrity I bugged for an autograph was Jim Kelly from Enter the Dragon.
Oh, no kidding.
Because I was such a humongous fan of that guy. I was like, and he, you know, the character, his character in Enter the Dragon and all his movies is so confident and cocky. And the real Jim Kelly was the gentlest, most soft-spoken guy you've ever met. So quiet and really kind and friendly. It was unbelievable that was that guy. He was really he was quite a good actor. But yeah, Sam Jones, I passed on meeting him and I regretted it after. But I did buy a box set of bootleg Highwayman DVDs because I watched every episode of Code Red because of Sam Jones.
Well, I'll give you two quick follow-ups. One, The Spirit.
Loved
he did a TV movie as The Spirit with Nana Visitor, who ended up being on Deep Space Nine in the early 90s, I think.
Teasdale. Yeah, I was a huge Spirit fan. I was really happy about Sam Jones playing him, and I caught it when ABC played it originally.
Well, it's now part of the Warner Brothers collection.
I haven't ordered it yet, but I will, yeah.
I think I might have to order it. And then another quick follow-up. I'm in New York a week or so ago in the hotel room. My wife is – we're, you know, both in the hotel room. She had done some work on the set of this thing for NBC in the morning, but most of the rest of the day she made it very clear she's probably going to have to be working while we're in the room here. So I'm keeping myself busy with reading, you know, my iPod, the occasional flipping around the TV because there's nothing on, or maybe I'll buy a movie or something. And then it's late at night, and I get to ESPN Classic, and they are running the Battle of the Network Stars back to back to back to back. I immediately grab my phone. I'm texting you going, oh, my God, you got to get to Gabe Kaplan is the captain of the team, and Lee Majors is commentating, and Shatner's the captain of the ABC team. And
you know how pissed off I was that I found out that's the only sports channel I don't pay for?
You would have been up all night because they showed – I got to it, and it was about 80, 81.
Yeah.
And I watched all through to like 85.
I was reading that like when a little kid would say, oh, my God, you didn't – They played Star Wars and it was free and they were handing out ice cream. You know, like just one of those weird things you're missing, you know, because you had to go do something else or your parents had to go to town.
Oh, I used to be addicted to these shows. And I stand by it as being one of the single greatest shows in the history of television because
that Fantasy Island for me.
You never got to see these people outside of – this is pre-internet. This is pre on every magazine or 24-hour news if they stub their toes. This is the only way you're going to see them do anything outside of their job.
How else would you know that Robert Conrad was a dick?
Exactly. Or that Scott Baio was the fastest human alive. He skunks everybody on every obstacle. He's like a little wizard. And Mark Harmon, who's a former college ball player, was just killing everybody on this thing. It was amazing to see. But then you'd have, the relay races, and you have like Tom Selleck, bringing up the rear, Gil Gerard or whatever. And then they had the big climactic tug of war between CBS and NBC, and the anchor on the CBS team was Sam J. Jones.
Yeah.
So this had 83, 84, 85, something like that.
Yeah.
Because he was still, I used to watch all that stuff too. He's a nice guy, and he was totally couldn't have been nicer at the booth. And I think he deep down wants something more to happen with the character. You know, Alex has had ideas for years about continuing that story that ended in the film to keep something going with it. But it is just one of these things. It's of its time. It definitely could only have been made when it was made. I feel it should have been much bigger than it was. Because it had so much going for it. The look of it, the sound effects, the design of even the ships and the guns. It didn't look like anything that came before or after.
Well, that's what I wanted to say is as a kid, I would draw spaceships. And after that movie, I became obsessed with drawing things with fins and adding an art deco to my spaceships. Like I have still my drawings when I was like 10 or 11. Mm. And I've become obsessed with retrofuturism. You know,
yeah.
Box robots, and it's weird because I'm 10.
And but just the weird, like you don't get many shots of it, but like Aura's shuttle is very specific. Ming's shuttle, the shuttle that Clytus is on,
Yeah, like, the one that Flash steals at the end.
It looks like a bug. It's got like bug. It's really strange.
I love and I still I have an obsession with spaceships that look like that. I will buy toys of spaceships that look like that. And I owe it all to that film.
The swords, the weapons, it's just a cool looking film. And even, you know, I'm not, again, not to sound too cheesy, but it's hard to have your hero in tight black pants, black pirate boots that fold over, and a tank top, and that's his whole outfit, and have him pull it off.
Mm-hmm.
And not look, you know, cheesy.
Or a shirt with his name on it.
Or a t-shirt with his own name on it, which is brilliant. I've since had my Flash Gordon t-shirt figures custom made to be the Freddie Mercury figure that NECA made. I had someone swap the torsos out, put Freddie's head back on, mm-hmm. put the torso back on the bottom half, painted the pants like blue jeans, and put, you know, Nikes on him. And it's basically Freddie Mercury in the video for Play the Game, the songs off of the game. He's wearing the Flash t-shirt in the video.
I actually ran out and saw Marauders Metropolis because Queen was involved with the soundtrack.
Oh, yeah, that's 84.
Yeah. I remember that in high school, running out and seeing
that. They did that Radio Gaga video.
Which I really, really don't like.
They had the Radio Gaga video with all the clips from Metropolis.
Yeah, I hate that song personally, but I did really want to see it because I was hoping for a repeat of that kind of Flash Gordon sound.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, it's a one-off. It's a one-of-a-kind. Like I say that you can compare loads of movies to other movies, or it's got a feel like this or a vibe like this. Flash Gordon stands on its own. It is a one-of-a-kind for a dozen reasons. And I get it if you don't like it. You don't have to like it. But there's something very special about it to me. And it's like a comforting thing to put on.
Well, you know what? I think a lot of the people that, especially, you know, like Leonard Maltin's of the world, they just... They were in awe of the Buster Crabs of the serials, and they were not in love with De Laurentiis, and they were not 10-year-old boys. So, you know, it all depends on where you are and who you are, and I think we, you know, it's our world now too, and we can now extol it for what it was, and it was a joyous, entertaining film.
Yes, and it's the scope of it too. You know, you see some of those sets.
Yeah,
there are some gorgeous sets and large rooms that they're in, and big things are happening. It was a big, big movie that obviously they wanted it to be much bigger. But it did well in Europe and every place else. They seem to eat it up. I also stand by. Maybe we should post this too. But the trailer, the advanced trailer for that is amazing. So. Check that out when you can, too.
We'll add all that stuff to the show notes for sure. I'm going to go through this, add everything from the Get Carter theme to, everything I can.
Awesome. And let us know what other merchandise you might have found, if anything else is out there we're missing if you're Flash Gordon people.
And if you have DVDs of Battle of the Network Stars and you're bored, you could mail them to me.
Best show ever made.
Well, I think that's it. I've got to go read a Nancy Drew book.
Hey, what a coincidence.
Yes. where, don't tell me the end.
All right. Another great show. Always a pleasure, Brian. Thanks for your time.
Awesome.
And thanks for listening, everybody.
Thanks, everybody.
Talk to you soon.
Take care.